Welcome to the Real Triathlon Podcast. I'm your host, Garrick Lowen, here with Nicholas Chase and Jackson Laundrie.
Welcome back to the Real Triathlon Podcast. Today, it's just me, myself, and I, and my amazing guest, Megan Foley. And hello. Megan, is this your second time on the podcast?
This is my first time on the podcast.
I feel like for some reason we had you on there, but I guess we've spent enough time together over the last year with Super League and just chit chatting. And also you only live about 3.5 hours north of me. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, we first met 2020, like mid pandemic.
I feel like we met before that.
Really? I remember like Bear Lake, the race in Bear Lake. We all stayed together.
Yeah. Maybe that is where I met you, but you're right. We do have a substantial amount of time hanging out together. And that might be the first time because also I was like, oh my gosh, look at these. Those you and Adrian, your husband. Are you guys officially married? I can't remember.
We're not officially married.
Pretty much. Partner Adrian, but BFF for life. I was like, you're traveling with your own coffee machine. We're best friends. And yeah. Adrian makes amazing bread and sourdough specifically, which was like one of my like weaknesses in life. So I always remember those.
Me going like into a race, right, is like good coffee and some solid carbs. So You got to bring them with you.
So a little background real quick as to why I wanted to bring Megan on. Megan is absolutely living the life of a pro triathlete and registered dietitian and sports dietitians. She knows it because she lives it, and she's surrounded by athletes all the time, and she hears all the feedback, the ups and downs, the things we all deal with. And for me, this is like the perfect expert out there, because that's why I'm a good coach, I think, because I live this every single day, and I wouldn't ask somebody to do something that I personally haven't experienced or gone through myself. And I think you're probably cut from that same cloth. Am I right, Megan?
Yeah, it definitely gives you an athlete's perspective, right? Of like, okay, well, I know what you're going through when I'm telling you to do these things, or I know the struggles that you've been dealing with because I've dealt with them myself. And so it's not necessary to have those qualities to be a good coach or a good dietitian, but it definitely helps.
I think it gives you a bit of an edge, because like personal experience in a lot of ways can save a lot of fumbling in terms of giving proper advice. And so I have a couple of topics I wanted to talk about today. I want to start off with a few lighter ones that are basically like blunders. Like, what are some of the things to this day? I mean, and obviously you still work with athletes, you work for Fuel In, which is all a partner of RTS also. So what kinds of current issues are you seeing as like a common trend or questions that are coming in pretty frequently?
Oh man, there's so many ways you can go wrong in nutrition, which is very like unfortunate, but then it also just makes it that much better when you get it right. So, you know, if we're talking about like outside of racing, right? Like, what are the biggest mistakes that people make in their day-to-day fueling? I would say a lot of athletes that I come across are trying to do everything right, right? They're trying to eat clean. They're trying to eat organic. They're trying to eat plant-based. And that's all well and good. But if you're not eating enough, then those things don't matter, right? Like, your diet is never going to be perfect if it's not adequate. And what I mean by that is that if you are eating all of these healthy plant-based foods, you know, all the salads or whatever, but you're consistently, you know, 1,000 calories under what you're expending or more, you're never going to reach your full potential as an athlete, because you're not going to get the recovery that's necessary in order to get better. And so that's probably the one that I see most often or most frequently, especially with endurance athletes, right? Because a lot of us are like the type A personality who wants everything to be perfect. But even a diet that's full of, you know, junk or processed foods or whatever it is, if you're meeting your needs, it's probably a better diet than one that's perfectly clean and organic and isn't like enough.
It makes perfect sense. I just, as a coach who kind of just gives anecdotal comments here and there on nutrition. It seems like if athletes can't get the meal in on time or whatever, then there's like 30 supplements and five shakes and all these additives. And it's like very market or it's very consumer driven marketing that we're all kind of being subjected to. And that also kind of gets in the way of what you're doing is it for your job. You're trying to keep things pretty simple. We're leaning heavy into blood test data. Obviously any wearable, anything we can, we're trying to use to diagnose where the deficiencies are. So how can we even start to figure out what we're lacking if we're not even consistently measuring and getting good test responses? So how do you recommend athletes as a baseline get in adequate calories throughout the day? Like just simply put, how do you put that together?
Yeah, I think there's a number of different ways to do it. I mean, the number one thing to look for is if you're running into issues, right? Like if you are consistently injured, if you are dealing with stress fractures frequently, if you feel more tired than usual, or if you're not seeing results in training that you thought you would see from the work that you've been doing, you know, those are kind of the big red flags that don't involve more detail. And so that's really easy ones for coaches to look out for is just kind of those like, hey, how's the athlete doing? Are they sleeping well? Whatever. But then if we're really getting into the weeds, that's what we do at Fuelin is we help athletes create these customized meal plans using macronutrients to say like, look, this is how much you actually need to be eating. We can track your food intake to see how you're doing. And then that can be more of like a hand-holding process to get the athletes back on track.
So just actually putting some quantifiable data to like a tracking system or, hey, I know that I ate X, Y, and Z for breakfast, lunch, dinner, plus snacks. This is my total intake load. By the way, based off of whatever metric you use to TSS or what have you, like I worked out for 4 hours today. Like you probably still burned another 2,500 to 4,500 calories during those periods of time. So by matter of fact, you still are going to bed 2,000 calories under the mark. And this happens routinely. And I think, Megan, could you touch on the importance of timing with nutrition? Because it seems to me with a busy lifestyle, athletes are frequently challenged with something came up, I couldn't eat, but I still had to go home and train, or I got home from work, I ate a big meal with my family, and then I had to go ride, run at 9 p.m. How are you handling that as a nutritionist for recommending adequate timing? And when is the best time to train for, you know, best gut, best recovery?
Yeah, it's so interesting when athletes put it like that, right? Because, you know, you're skipping meals, but you won't skip a workout. And that thought process is just so interesting to me of like, how did we get to this point where it's better to go into a workout and just absolutely wreck yourself and not, you know, fuel it appropriately or recover appropriately from it. And that seems like a better option than, you know, eating an actual meal or at least having a snack. So I think with athletes, it's really important to just have things that are easily available and convenient, right? Like food doesn't need to be complicated in order for it to be good. So like having things on hand that you can grab right before a workout that are providing like a little bit of carbohydrate, but not necessarily a lot of like fat or fiber or protein, because those things tend to slow down digestion or give us like more GI issues. So this could be something as simple as like an applesauce packet or a granola bar, or even
rice,
just having.
What about Rice Krispie treats? Those are my always go-to.
Love Rice Krispie treats. Yeah. Yeah. Just like a simple carbohydrate source, right? So like, even if you're not able to get a full meal in, you just have something that you can grab and go, and then that will give you a better result out of your workout. As far as timing of workouts, like with age groupers, you gotta get it in where you can, right? Like sport is not for most age groupers your main focus in life. And so it's about then fitting it in where you can and then fitting in nutrition around it where you can. So if you're working out at 5 a.m. in the morning, like I know a lot of age groupers do, it means, you know, having those quick snacks beforehand, or even maybe loading a bit more like on the bike or on the run, just to make sure that you're getting the nutrition that you need. But then, you know, the main take home here is that you're getting the most out of the work that you're doing, right? Like nutrition, good nutrition allows you to benefit the most from the work that you're already doing. It's not like, oh, I need to go do this extra run or this extra bike. Like, no, just get the most out of the work that you're already doing. And I think that's kind of the take home message.
Yeah, you're either fueling for the next performance or the next bit of recovery. And in between, you have a lot to play with there. Of course, there's probably bigger periods of downtime between like 9 a.m. to about 3 p.m. where athletes are more like tied up at work or with obligations outside of training, to where they probably do have to focus on like, shoot, everyone's going out to lunch today. I guess I'll just have some, and I got to get home and train straight away. So I probably need something simple. Like for me, I always noticed when I was on the Whole Foods, not shopping at Whole Foods because that's too expensive, but the Whole Foods diet, where I'm trying to make sure I'm getting more leafy greens because everyone's, you know, got to get all the greens, all the colors of the rainbow. I would just show up in the evening so bloated and almost just like feeling awful. So on the big training days after, you know, work, I would always make, and this was when I was in the Air Force, I'd make sure I'd have like some simple carbs, a little bit of protein, and that was almost kind of it. I would avoid eating a lot of the foliage until after training, when I could get it in before bed. And I think that's where we have to, would you recommend maybe breaking up some of this kind of paradigm of like, you've got to really get a lot in during the day in terms of high volume foods versus high calorie foods, like volume in terms of like nutritional benefit. And then sometimes you just got to focus on the calories directly. That way, when you do get home, you're topped off and then you can replenish at night before you go to bed. Is that something, or am I crazy for saying that?
No, you got to fit the fiber in where it makes sense, right? Like the leafy greens, the veggies, the fruits, like some of the whole grain breads and stuff, like that can mess up your gut if you're trying to eat that and then go train. Like it's not in athletes' heads that that's an issue. And so I totally understand the need to wait and have those foods later in the day. I think, you know, you kind of spoke about it. It's about what, finding out what works for you, right? Like finding those foods that work for you. They're not going to be the same for everyone. I remember a few years ago, I was working with a coach and we always used to do triple run days. And they were always run days, right?
So I'm going to eat like rice only.
Yeah. So then you have to figure out like, okay, how the heck do I actually eat food today and not just like poop my pants for every single run going out and doing? And so for me, like I could handle a little bit of spinach, a little bit, like cook it down, mix it with some rice and have some eggs. And then I have my bases covered, right? So yeah. I'm primarily getting carbs from the rice. There's very little fiber in it. I'm still getting a small amount of greens, although I would save it till the end of the day because like you, I'm not a psychopath and I don't want to be making bathroom stops like every 5 minutes when I'm out running. And then I'm getting protein from like a very simple source. Eggs work for me, but you know, I've seen other athletes do protein shakes or dairy, or it's just finding out like what works for you. And sometimes that just means saving the high fiber foods till after training is over.
I know. And I'll kind of end on the nutritional blunders and all these little intricacies with kind of a little bit of a personal experience, because I have been doing this long enough to kind of try all the different dietary fads. I know this is incredibly hard for those who are trying to stick to a planned dietary mindset, whether it's a keto, pescatarian, vegetarian, vegan. That's inherently more difficult because if you're not as carb heavy, you're going to be very much focused on a lot of fiber rich aspects, which are going to cause, you know, could or could not cause issues. I've seen athletes who are vegan and they just don't ever have an issue, but they're probably so used to it because their guts are really good.
Yes.
But I noticed like throughout the day, and I think this is probably standard for most pro triathletes, like we probably all have some sort of eggs and bread and avocado or some toast in the morning.
It's a great combo.
It is. that's like been my post workout or sometimes pre bike ride. And then sometimes for lunch, it's so simple because I know I've got to go swim after that, or I've got an evening run. I'll do maybe some tortilla chips. I'll do some more rice. I probably don't take in much animal protein until the evening after I'm really done training, because sometimes that does tend to sit unless it's like a very light shredded chicken. So for me, I had to figure out the hard way many times that I got to get all my nutritional content after like 5 p.m. And sometimes that's two dinners. Sometimes it's a dinner and a late night snack. And is it bad, Megan, if I'm like, it's 9 p.m. and I need to still get in some calories? I mean, obviously, I'm going to try to avoid heavy, heavy sugars that are going to keep me wired. But what do you think are like really good late night snacks that people can lean into if they need to get some extra calories in before they go to bed?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's worse to go to bed with a massive calorie deficit than it is to eat at 9 p.m., right? Like, your body doesn't know the difference between 9 p.m. and 8:55. Like, there's no time cutoff where all of a sudden, like, all the foods that you're eating are going to be turned into fat for some reason. Like, if your body needs the calories, it needs the calories. But, you know, for a lot of people, especially athletes, we always focus on carbs with endurance athletes, right? Because carbs are your body's primary fuel source during moderate to high intensity activity. So we focus on carbs, carbs, carbs a lot of the day. And I think a lot of endurance athletes could do a better job of ingesting more protein. And so having a higher protein snack right before bed can actually be really beneficial for people. I mean, one, it helps to keep you fuller than a macronutrient like carbohydrates do. But then two, if you've underconsumed your protein throughout the day, then it's just that extra top off section set, extra top off meal.
The cherry on top.
Yes. Thank you. That's a great way to put it. just to help you like get that extra dose in, and then, you know, stimulating muscle protein synthesis and repair overnight. So this could be, cottage cheese. This could be like a bowl of cereal with milk. A lot of people do Greek yogurt. You could do animal protein. I guess dairy is animal protein, but if you wanted to do like something else, you could. Or of course, you know, anything that's soy based for the vegan vegetarian population would be a good choice as well.
Nice. I think those are all super helpful tips. I think you've also have to draw the line between a sweet tooth and actually needing some calories. Like for me, I don't even try to undereat, but typically if I don't make sure I get those kind of junk calories in throughout the day, I will lean out. Like I know I've got this pair of running shorts that I know that I'm too lean when I fit into them and I'm like not kind of coming out of the top of the muffin top area. And so that's my indication, like I need to eat a lot more over these next 4 to 5 days. So, because for me, when I lack power or buoyancy or strength, it's because I'm probably 2 to 3 pounds light. And for the pro athletes, I think this is a fine line. For the age group athletes, it's also like stress eating or, you know, feeling like just bored. You know, I think there's a lot of other aspects to be considered. Like, and that's where I think working with a fuel in specialist like yourself, or even using an app to kind of calculate what you're getting in for like a week is beneficial. Cause then, you know, like, wow, I am 1,000 calories under every day. And I'm about X amount of grams of protein under, and I'm a female and I'm postmenopausal and I need more protein than anybody. So these things are great. And that's probably what you're most focused on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, food, one of the reasons that I got into nutrition was because obviously I saw the relationship between food and athletic performance. That was like the key driver of why I was like, okay, I want to do this.
Yeah.
But we also have to recognize that food is so much more than that. Like, it's not just nutrients. It's like your connection to your family or memories you have of eating with your grandparents, right? It's connection with other people. Like a lot of the times if I go out and see friends, we're grabbing a coffee or grabbing a meal. There's so many areas intertwined in our lives that like food is a part of that. And so I really, really love that aspect of like talking to people about food. And I think that's why it's really helpful to work with someone who's a nutritionist or a dietitian and kind of understands that like there's all sorts of reasons that people choose to eat. And, you know, figuring out like, is this a performance benefit? Is this a happiness benefit? Like, how are we making these foods fit into our diet? And stress eating is a part of that for some people. And so then talking to a professional about like, hey, how do we manage this? Or what other areas in your life can you find happiness from? Like, it's food is so much a part of everything. And I really love that about working with athletes and people.
Yeah. And I think we don't often bring to the table, like, we all have a struggle with some aspect of food. Like, I think it's been crammed down our throats. We see it all the time. We drive by it all the time. We're a hungry culture. We want it now and we want it to be good. I think that even personally, I used maybe 5-6 years ago, it'd be late at night. And it was during the period when I was most focused on trying to be really strong and focused on my diet and being strict to a protocol. I had the worst cravings and I was mentally unhappy. And I ended up binge eating more in the evenings to where I'd be like, oh man, now I feel like I gotta go throw up. I just ate like a whole row of Oreos. And so I think you got to go through some point of this, like to teach yourself there's a way out of it. And typically it's like, eat what you like to a point that is satiating your want for that thing. And if you tell yourself you can't have it enough, you're going to eat a shitload of it. So just be human, but have some limits. And then if it gets totally out of line, work with somebody like Megan, who can kind of help you rein it back and put some quantification as to like, yeah, I know you're hungry at night, but you ate like a bag of pistachios and that was about 3,000 calories, man.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I will tell people, you know, there's no bad foods. There's only bad portion sizes, right? Like, fair. Generally people consider broccoli to be a healthy food, right? Like, you're not going to get much argument if I say that. But then if I say, okay, you need to eat 10 cups of broccoli, that's not a good food for you. Like, you are going to have so much like bloating and other terrible problems if you go out 10 cups of broccoli. Like, yeah, it's all about balance. And then of course, you know, there's the mindset piece of it as well, right? Like, if I tell you, all right, you can't eat bread, I guarantee you are going to think about bread nonstop for the next, like, for the rest of your life, because you were told that you can't have it. So, you know, the mindset definitely is a piece of it as well.
So moving on from some of the common things we all deal with and think about as athletes who are trying to focus on nutrition, this happens every year and it starts to get hot and most races are like in the heat. I don't know why. They're like, well, you know, let's not do a lot of spring or early season or late season, you know, fall, summer. Let's do most of our racing peak heat when it's
really tough. They can take it, whatever.
How do you handle athletes who are, you know, well, let's transition into actual race day competition fueling. How do you have athletes adjust their intake of calories, sodium, whatever you macros even? How does that change when the temperatures are above 80 degrees and it's beating down sun? What do you kind of cater to with those situations?
Yeah, I think number one is, even before race day, athletes need to practice taking in fuel during training, right? That's kind of number one, that you're set up when you actually get on the race course to take in food. But there are a couple of physiological changes that happen in hotter weather. So number one is that when we exercise, our blood flow is diverted away from our digestive system and towards our working muscles, right? It's also trying to like get closer to our skin so it can cool us down. So we have like increased sweating, but because we have less blood flow to the digestive system, this puts us at increased risk for GI problems and heat. And coupled with that, is that for events that are happening in hotter weather, your relative intensity is higher for the same output, right? Like, if you are running a 7 minute mile pace in 60 degrees, it's going to feel a whole lot easier than running a 7 minute mile pace at in 90 degrees.
Might not even be able to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the intensity just goes through the roof. And when our intensity goes up, so does our reliance on glucose or muscle glycogen. So we tend to run through these stores a whole lot more quickly than we would in cooler weather conditions. So athletes need to be aware of this. They're going to be burning fuel more quickly. And so they may need to, definitely take in more hydration, but they need to be aware that they're going to be burning carbs more quickly and then therefore might need more in hotter race conditions as well. When it comes to sodium is really beneficial for helping us to drink more. So it helps to stimulate a thirst response. And so adding in some sodium to your fuel products can be beneficial. I think a lot of athletes make the mistake of trying to replace 100% of their sodium losses. Like, you don't need to replace it all, but replacing some will definitely be a benefit. So those are the kind of things that I like to focus on with people, but it all starts with practice and making sure that you can tolerate it in training before you get out there on race day.
Hell yeah. Just simulating anything you can before race day is going to be impressive, especially like you got five of your friends who are gonna like swim with you. Like, start with them in the same lane and feel some bodies in contact. Like, anything you can train before the race, you should train before the race.
Totally. And it's like the people who don't practice swimming before they get into an Ironman, like it's the same with nutrition. Like, most people know better than to not swim or bike or run before going into a race, but a lot of people don't think about their nutrition before going into a race. And it has a similar impact on the day. So it is something that you need to focus on.
And I think something else to touch on is the level of exposure you have on the day. Some athletes are out there for 8 hours and some are out there for 16-ish hours. And I think that drastically changes how you fuel as an athlete. If you are a 13 hour and beyond finisher, I think you have to plan in some more solid foods and an opportunity to get in something that's going to fill your stomach more than just liquid calories, which is most of the pro field, all liquid calories. Anyone probably sub 10 going to be most liquid calories. And in the heat, especially, like, I always tell athletes, and correct me if this is dumb, but I just tell them to think of themselves as being on an IV drip of calories. You want to take in things lower dose, but more frequently, because the concentration, if that is too high, as you stated, like, your stomach just can't do anything with it and it's going to sit. And then the more you put in there is going to sit. And the only way to get that out is to get it out.
Right.
How in those hot conditions, like, let's say you've got, you know, a mixture of carbs, sodium, and you want to get in a little bit of protein. You know, there's all kinds of different products, but if you're a sub 12, you know, athlete, what would you kind of put together in terms of like types of, it doesn't have to be brand specific, but what kind of stuff would you say you should do, spread it out over just the bike ride?
Yeah, I think
like build me a, let's just put it more simple. I'm racing Ironman Texas next weekend. And I want to know, and I want to know what I should be taking in on the bike. How would you staple, or I guess partition all those things out?
Yeah. I mean, you're going to hate this answer, but it really does depend on the athlete.
It does. And
what they have done previously in training. So I'm not going to recommend, even if they are sub 12 hours, like, I'm not going to recommend to people the exact same thing. But if, you know, it's a hot, like a pretty powerful age group male, I would probably say at least around 90 grams of carb per hour is probably a safe place to start.
Yeah. I'm like maybe 160 pounds, 170 pounds, something like that. I'm a unit.
Maybe as a background in the Air Force. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we start to get over 60 grams of carbohydrate an hour, we need to consider that it comes from multiple sources of carbohydrate, meaning a mix of both glucose and fructose, because we have two different transporters in our gut that we can use. And so getting a mix of those two different sugars makes sure that you, ensures that you're maximizing your uptake out of your digestive system.
Is that mainly because like the fructose will get taken up more quickly and utilized, while if you were strictly doing like a malto or a more complex sugar, the breakdown rate and almost like the availability takes too long, so you could experience like a lot of just negative effects of not having that instant sugar?
Yeah, so they use two different transporters. So the glucose uses a I need to look it up. I looked it up a few days ago and now I've forgotten. Yeah, they use two different transporters. So the glucose uses one transporter. It's including a sodium dependent glucose transporter. And then there's a fructose transporter. So the fructose actually goes to the liver where it's converted into glucose and then circulated, whereas the glucose uses a different transporter. So by using two different transporters, you're able to maximize your absorption out of the intestines and then therefore have a higher oxidation rate of sugars during exercise. So that's the reason that you want to have a combination of two. And so you need to look for products that give you that combination of two. So it's better to choose something that offers both a glucose or a maltodextrin and a fructose comparatively to just a single sugar source.
Yeah. I just Googled it quickly.
It's like GLUT5 and GLUT1 or GLUT2, I believe.
Yeah. Express GLUT2, microalgae express GLUT5.
Yeah.
So yes, there are definitely two. And some are permeable to certain cell membranes versus others, apparently. And that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. And there's actually more than two, but those are kind of the main ones that we talk about in sport. We know a lot about this, but we could know more as far as like, you know, we don't know the optimal ratio of glucose to fructose. We used to think it was 2-to-1. Now we think it's, you know, it could be 1-to-1. It could be 1-to-0.8.
Athletes can't tolerate fructose because it gets a little bit too alcohol and like too much fermentation, and then they get just bloat. Like, that's why I think a lot of companies weren't putting a lot of fructose in drink mixes, because they were scared of all the GI distress that could be associated with it.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like the higher you go with your carbohydrate intake after a certain point, you are more likely to experience GI issues. And we tend to see that happen over 90 grams was kind of like what we used to think it was. And now, you know, some athletes may still experience that, but we've also seen athletes take in 120, 140 grams of carb an hour. So we're still trying to figure out what the right amount is, but it's, you know, for the average age group athlete, it's going to be individual to you. And I would say that, one, hopefully you've practiced it in training, but if you haven't, you know, 90 grams is probably a solid place to start if you're a faster athlete.
So do you think that the reason why we're seeing such large calorie or carbohydrate intake is because that's also a probable trainable aspect of the gut, like the tolerance that you can sustain, your transport mechanisms might increase, your gut permeability might change. So
sure,
that way you're not like getting too much, because I've always equated it to like the body has a certain pH. Everybody's pH is going to be specific to them. That's roughly within there. And that's determined by like blood plasma levels and whatever's going on in the stomach. And like, if the pH changes too aggressively in anything, there's a time and period where it's going to like, nothing's going to happen until it gets leveled out. And so for me, if it's hot, and my blood's not even in my stomach because it's cooling me off and providing oxygen, and I'm concentrating my drinks because I'm in an Ironman and I only want to carry 2 or 3 bottles and I don't want to rely on anything on course. Like, that's where I think we're getting into these actual circumstances that are causing problems. So I've always been recommending athletes, if they do concentrate bottles, that they draw some lines on those bottles to where they can roughly assess how much they're concentrating in their current feed bottle versus their concentrate bottle. And that's the tough part, right, Meg? Like, if we're supposed to take in this much per hour on the bike, but I don't want to take in Mortal Energy or Morton or just random gels on the bike course, like how do athletes get it all in, right? You've either got to carry it or you've got to make do with what the course has, right?
Yeah, it definitely is a challenge for a lot of athletes. And I think, you kind of touched on it when we have these super concentrated bottles, you are more likely to experience GI distress, especially if you are under hydrating, right? And I feel like, especially in hot environments, that tends to happen more easily with athletes. And so they tend to, rely on these super concentrated bottles and then aren't drinking enough water, and then just chaos ensues. Like, gut bloating happens, they stop digesting the nutrients that are there and experience problems.
Yeah, I think what's the other athlete is I'm just going to take whatever's on course and go with that. That's probably like 60% of Ironman athletes. So Meg, we know like Ironman races are currently going to have Martin products, Mortal Energy, probably some raw foods, bananas, chips,
Yeah.
water, cola, maybe Red Bull. I don't know if they're still going to be out there at some races, but what are a lot of the issues we see with some of these crazy things that anybody can grab at any given time without any training to know what the hell they're doing?
Yeah, I hope they keep the Coke. Please let them keep Coke. That's
Yeah.
like a lifesaver for so many people.
I
It's like
know.
perfectly sweet. It's got caffeine in it. Don't get rid of the Coke. But yeah, I mean, this all comes back to practicing your nutrition, right? That's where most people could improve upon. It doesn't matter if it's available on course or you're carrying it yourself. Like, you need to practice what you plan to do on race day. So if you are planning on relying on what's available at aid stations, like the chips, like the bananas, like this Mortal Hydration new electrolyte product that's out there, you need to practice it before you get out there. Otherwise, it could be problematic for you. Like, and that's a terrible reason to have a bad race, right? Like, you've done all the work, you've done all the training, and then your stomach just says, nah, we're not doing this today. Like, I'm unhappy and I'm just gonna get rid of whatever is in here. So, touching on the Mortal Hydration thing, it's a very different product to Gatorade Endurance. Like, I think that's kind of the major thing that stuck out to me when I heard these announcements that there was going to be this new product on course, because Gatorade Endurance provided some carbohydrate along with it. And, I don't know the numbers quite off the top of my head, but it was a some electrolyte, but not like an insane amount. It was probably around 300 to 450 milligrams per serving. Whereas this Mortal Hydration, it's between 500 milligrams for like their regular version, and then their salty version is like 900 milligrams of sodium per serving. So it's
Yeah, I've
significant.
got it pulled up from the Fuelin website or the Fuelin Instagram.
Yeah.
The Mortal Hydration sodium 460, carb 10 grams, and then the saltier one is 900 milligrams, carbs 10 grams.
Yes.
And I don't remember what Gatorade was, but it was similar.
They had
But
a bunch of Gatorade has a bunch of sports science people working for them. So I'm assuming they were within the College of Sports Science recommendations, which is between 300 and 500 milligrams per serving, would be my assumption. So Mortal is a whole lot more than that. So people need to be aware of that. And it's not providing carbohydrate. It's like 10 grams per serving, which is really not much.
yeah.
So if you were planning on relying on this as a fuel source, it's not the best option. And it's also not a one-to-one switch for Gatorade Endurance, right? Like, there seems to be significant differences between the two products to where you can't just say, oh, well, I used to have Gatorade Endurance as my electrolyte. I'm just going to go to Mortal and it's going to work out great. Like, there could be potential issues there because the sodium content is so much higher. I think we also need to be aware of the fact that the Mortal Hydration has stevia in it, which is a non-nutritive sweetener or an artificial. I guess stevia isn't artificial sweetener; it's from a natural source. But
Leaf,
it's a
right?
non, yeah, it's a non-nutritive sweetener, meaning it doesn't really contribute to your carb or your calorie
Sure.
intake. Yes, so it tends to be like these non-nutritive sweeteners tend to be 10 to 100 times sweeter than regular sugars. So, they're not using a ton of it, but it is present in the product. And some people are sensitive to it, meaning it can cause gas, or bloating. The stevia tends to cause less of these issues than some of the other artificial sugars out there. But again, this would be a really brutal time while you're out on the race course to figure out that you are sensitive to stevia. Yeah, so people just need to be mindful of that.
I think it's a great product that you've got to try first for sure. I mean, there's probably, you know, nothing wrong with it outside of just make sure, since the stevia's in there, because those drinks that are like called Zevia or whatever, that are purely like stevia sodas, like those just make my stomach stick out like I'm pregnant, because there's just so much sugar alcohol getting in there. And I don't know what it does other than just make me feel like bloated. So I probably tend to avoid that unless it's a, you know, worst case Ontario.
Yeah. Yeah. So stevia isn't digested until it reaches your large intestine. And then it's fermented by the gut bacteria in your large intestine. And so that's what causes the gas and the bloating. So that's the reason why people experience those wonderful symptoms they experience.
Yeah. And we're not saying it's inherently bad, just something to be aware of.
Yes.
So you'll have Morton products, which are going to probably be more where you're going to get your carbs from, your gels. And yes, they won't have any Morton drink mix out there, to my knowledge, but I do believe more of the gels, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we kind of chatted about this, like, you know, are they offering this Morton, or not Morton, the Mortal hydration on the bike? Like, are they just going to be handing people their individual electrolyte packets, like as a hand up that they have to make themselves? Like, I think there's still a few questions to be answered.
Well, how scary is it when you
after Ironman Texas?
Well, yeah, exactly. And how scary is it when you get like a little cup of Gatorade and it's like the most potent mixed ratio from Gatorade to very little water? So I hope for the Mortal hydration, they really stick to some mixture standards that we can rely on. Because man, sometimes you get one of those in your eye and it just burns.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I've had some horrible experiences of like going for the electrolyte cup and thinking it went in my mouth and it just went straight into my eyes, and then running blind for the next mile and a half.
Yeah. So that kind of covers another major thing I wanted to chat with you on. And I think that, I don't know, have you heard many other opinions about Mortal? Is it Mortal hydration is what it's called? Have you heard anything else from any other athletes? Any concerns? What is the consensus? Just test it?
Yeah, I think I haven't really heard any other concerns other than just, you know, knowing that it's a different product and that you'll need to practice with it, right? Like everyone who I've spoken with who's actually tried it, who's an athlete, has really enjoyed the product. They enjoy the taste. They enjoy that it helps them to stay hydrated because there's a lot of sodium in it, and so they tend to drink more. But, you know, it is one of those things where you can't just go into race day and expect to use it and have everything. I mean, there's a chance that everything could work out great, but it would be in your best interest to practice it beforehand. And it's not the same product as Gatorade Endurance.
Exactly. And a cool point that I think I can bring up, I've been doing persistent hydration, sweat, and sodium analysis testing for over 3 years now, I think. And hundreds of tests over tons of athletes, from ultra runner to triathlon, any endurance sport, even motorcycle racers. So like what I've found, most athletes, and I was part of this and I didn't know what the hell I was doing until I got this data. Like I was losing around 1100 milligrams of sodium per liter of sweat that my body would produce. And the sodium content of my sweat is always going to be roughly the same, but the volume of sweat will change based on the surroundings and my environment, et cetera. So what I've noticed most importantly is that most athletes are around 600 to about even 900 kind of average loss of sodium milligrams per liter of lost volume. And I think that's where you've got to do a sodium analysis or test and then a sweat loss test to figure out, if it's 80 degrees and 85 degree or 80% humidity, I lose 1.8 liters of per hour or something to that effect. So that's really like a piece of knowledge a lot of athletes, I think, are starting to take more into care. And I'm glad to see that there's more emphasis on hey, we have some higher sodium products out here because you might be losing 200% more than what we're able to provide you on course. And so now there's a 900 milligram option to just guzzle, and who knows how much you're taking in, but at least you're getting some in.
Right. It's definitely a very high sodium product. And so for those athletes that are looking for a high sodium replacement option, this will definitely be that for them.
Yeah. So that's cool. I mean, I think the sodium world is almost equally as important as the carbohydrate world, as we're starting to look at the longevity, like hours and hours into an event, you'll just lose your ability for repeatable muscle contractions if your body just doesn't have good blood plasma volume through sodium and everything like that. So I'm stoked. So hopefully motor hydration causes zero problems.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very excited to see how Texas goes for everyone. I mean, yeah, obviously from a nutrition standpoint, but then also just for all of my friends who are racing and athletes who are racing, it's a exciting event.
So Meg, I think that we've probably hit a point in our triathlon, I guess. We've been around enough doing this enough. Like, I think I take as a coach race nutrition, not even like most athletes who are just signing up to do a marathon or whatever, they're going to just carb load the day before. I have a whole week protocol that I put athletes through, starting Monday on the race week, working them all the way through to where it's a scaled approach to carbohydrate intake, drawing down fiber, drawing down fat, and then prioritizing certain areas between what the athlete specifically needs, because I know that I've worked with them before. Is that pretty common, or is it just some coaches are doing that?
I don't think all coaches are doing that. I think, you know, not all coaches have a strong nutritional focus, but when it comes to race week, it's really important for athletes to have a routine that's familiar to them, that they've practiced, that they know they will feel comfortable and great going into race day. So I think that's extra important. And yeah, carb loading can be difficult for a lot of athletes. Like, the amount of carbs that you need to take in order to super compensate glycogen stores is a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it may need to be more than one day prior to racing. It could be, you know, 2 to 3 days at least of a higher carb intake, minimizing fiber. Don't eat spicy food before race. Yeah. I feel like I shouldn't say that as often as I do say it, but yeah, it's definitely a process that needs to be nailed down. And so it's very good to have that dialed in before going into race season.
And what are some common, like, race day breakfast things you should probably avoid? What are your number one, two, and three on that?
Number one, nothing new, I think, is probably the easiest one. So nothing new on race day, and that still applies to the morning of before the race starts. And then the other ones are, try to avoid foods that are known to cause delayed gastric emptying or GI distress. And that primarily comes down to fat, fiber, and super high amounts of protein need to be minimized. So a lot of athletes will go for things like overnight oats as a good example, as long as the fiber isn't an issue. My personal favorite is rice, either with soy sauce or banana and honey. With the honey, you get like the fructose along with the glucose, which is a nice. Or athletes can just go for like a plain bagel or toast or something along those lines and tend to do pretty well.
Yeah, I think maple syrup's starting to make another comeback again, since it's a just amazing source of, you know, trace minerals and good sugar.
Yeah, definitely a good one. It's similar chemical composition to table sugar. So it's just sucrose, but in liquid form, mixes in easily. And that's, sucrose is a glucose and a fructose molecule together. So nice. Good option.
How do you feel about just oatmeal or rolled oats?
I think it's good for some athletes. It really depends on if that's something that they eat like day to day. For me, it would be too much fiber personally. But if it's something that you literally have every morning of your life, then race day, it's probably okay as well.
I've always kind of thought, and I did do oatmeal forever and ever ago. and I would like kind of burp it up sometimes during like the bike. And I think that it's just such a complex carb that it just takes a while for me to break down. So I had to cut that one out, unfortunately, but I do love oatmeal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a higher fiber option. And it also depends on the oats, right? Like if you're doing instant versus old fashioned versus steel yeah. cut, whatever, like, but yeah, some athletes tolerate it really well and others do not. So that's just down to personal preference and practice.
How about like what fat and proteins should you probably avoid race morning?
Well, you don't want to go super heavy in either. So I'd say, unfortunately, a lot of bacon is probably off the table. A lot of sausage is probably off the table. You know, it's these foods that are more likely to cause issues. So a lot of people, when they think carb loading, think like, oh, I can just go out and have donuts. And that's like a great carb loading option, which a little bit is fine, but the fat content of donuts is probably a bit too high to fully rely on it for carb loading and or race breakfast.
That's so funny. I've tried a little bit of everything. Like I was with Marino Van Honacker once before a race, and he ate like 6 candy bars for dinner the night before the race. And then for breakfast, he had a couple more candy bars, like fat, sugar, salt, everything you could get, candy.
Yeah.
I've been around another pro athlete who was like, and you know who it is, legit just eating ice cream.
Yes.
Like tons of really
big races. Yeah. Winning, just eating ice cream
winning.
The day before. Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's crazy. And I think, you know, like we have all these general guidelines, right? But then it also comes down to personal tolerance too, of like, you know, if this works for you and you're getting the results, like, you know, more power to you, right?
I wish I could just like eat a pizza, and that's like all race
pretty good ever. for the day before, as long as you go light on the cheese, like don't go super super heavy on cheese, and pizza is a good option prior to race day.
Yeah, some people do sushi. I had an athlete who was like, I gotta have sushi for dinner the night before race. I was like, oh boy, have fun doing that everywhere you go travel to.
I feel like I heard a rumor that like Christian Blumenfeld did Panda Express prior to winning St. George when it was.
That's probable. I mean, some lo mein. I don't know. It probably doesn't get
stuff. Some orange chicken.
tons of sodium. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Meg, do you think sodium loading is beneficial also?
Yes and no. I think if someone is prone to losing a lot of sodium, it can be beneficial. Or if the race day is projected to be super hot, then it can be beneficial for some athletes. And I think, again, it's the answer that I always come back to. It's something that needs to be practiced.
It depends.
Yeah. It's very, very individual to each athlete.
Have you heard any feedback on the Morton bicarb?
I don't know. Actually, I do know one person who's used it, and they liked it well enough. So sodium bicarb works by buffering lactic acid, right? So when we have these like huge spikes above thresholds, we get lactic acid production, and sodium bicarb is there to like buffer that. So you're better able to tolerate these like spikes that happen in racing. The downside of bicarb in general, not the Morton bicarb, but just bicarb as a supplement, is that it can cause a lot of GI issues. And I remember when I was in grad school reading about sodium bicarb, and you're reading these like scientific papers, and they're trying to scientifically say these athletes had explosive diarrhea. And it was just like comical to come across like the different ways they were trying to explain like these really bad side effects that people were having from sodium bicarb. But the reason that Morton has the gel along with it is to prevent these negative GI distress issues that happen along with it.
Yeah.
So I think it, you know, it is proven to be beneficial for athletes if they don't get GI distress. It is a proven supplement that can benefit performance if GI distress does not occur. So it's something to be considered.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm a bigger fan of beta alanine, which has a similar effect. It helps to like buffer that super, super high intensity effort, but it has a longer loading period. So generally 1 to 2 months prior to racing, you'll take it frequently. It's actually a lot of supplement, usually between 3.2 or 6.4 milligrams per day, grams per day.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, but you don't have the negative GI effects that are possible with sodium bicarb. So I will generally recommend that to athletes first prior to recommending the bicarb.
I definitely bought the bicarb a year ago to try. And I think I guess it was still like, we don't know if it's going to benefit long course athletes, because we know for sure it benefits the short 5K high intensity VO2 max efforts. Like, we know that. And I think at certain periods of the swim as pro athletes, you probably hit those peak paces. So I was going to try it, but I kind of just opted not to, because there was, for my breakfast, my nutrition program, like, it was just a lot of influx. It was like 6,000 milligrams of sodium. It's a lot of sodium. And I did it during training. I didn't have any issues, but I didn't also feel like it made the biggest boom for my buck. So I agree. Like, those, some of the supplements, like, what is it? Optigen from First Endurance, which is like nitric oxide plus other stuff. Or there's that new company like Zendurance, who Ironman, I think, even works with, which there's supplements there that will like have beta-alanine mixtures with, you know, beetroot, all that stuff. So the supplement industry is still raining hard, making a lot of money off of us. But I don't know. That Martin one, I was really curious to see if you had any experiences or knew about it, because I haven't heard anyone having to crap their pants on it, but I haven't really known it's beneficial yet.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the athlete that I know that's used it had a positive experience with it. It's just, you know, the years of reading research, not Martin, but just sodium bicarbonate in general has, it's not the first thing that I will say to people. And again, you know, supplements are not going to benefit you more than adequate sleep, enough nutrition, focusing on hydration, right? Like, if you don't have those basics down packed, then a little extra additional supplement isn't going to do much for you at all. So
unless they're going
correct, unless they are banned in sport, and then we're having a whole different conversation. But you know, when we're talking like biggest bang for your buck, it's nailing the basics first. And the basics are good nutrition, good hydration, adequate sleep, and stress management.
I think that's a great place to kind of tidy this episode up, is everything we've talked about is very, you know, circumstantial. It changes a lot based off the environment, but the foundation you just kind of set is like not going to change no matter what race it is. Your mindset and your fueling and your pacing is all you have on race day. And if you can manage those things well throughout your day-to-day training environments, and especially most coaches will give you some opportunities to have big days, whether it's a 4 or 5 hour bike ride with a quick runoff and then maybe an evening swim, like, those are good times to test everything. And I think that's the best part about this sport, is race day is typically a celebration of everything you've already done over and over and over again. It's like, well, what do you do during taper week? I'd probably swim, bike, run. What do you do the day before the race? I'll probably do a swim, bike, run. And then what do you do on race day? You just do it all over again with massive, all things tied together and people around you to celebrate. So I think that's what the best part about this sport is there's really not a lot you can do wrong except for make some knee-jerk decisions that are going to put you in an untested territory that is probably going to have a problem.
For sure. And I think you kind of said it, it's consistency, right? Like, it's consistency in the day-to-day, it's consistency in your training. Those are the things that are going to give you the biggest benefit on race day. And so making sure that you have those first are going to get you much better results than focusing on this 1%.
All right. Well, we will end on this, Megan. I'm going to ask you a question I didn't ask you to prepare for, which most of this you prepare for. You just know it. If you have a recommendation on a book relating to either nutrition or training or something that's been transformative for you based off of this author or their experience, which book would that be?
Oh man, a book. You're probably hating most of my answers today, because the only books that I read are like journal articles, or I have like clinical textbooks in my house. So maybe that's not the best recommendation for people.
I mean, someone might read it. I don't know.
I do have a coworker. His name's Alan McCubbin, who does sports dietitian podcasts. And so if you are looking for accredited advice from someone, that would probably be a really great place to start. And it's called Fueling Endurance with 1L. I've really, really enjoyed his podcast, because it's a sports dietitian talking to other sports dietitians about sports nutrition topics.
Ooh.
So that would be a really great tool for people.
Yeah, I like it. I see it. He even has an episode, Do You Need Salt Tablets with Diet with Al
Yes.
His picture on his like ResearchGate website, he's like at the smirk. He's like, it's so funny.
He is much smarter than I am. He most of his research has been on sodium intake in athletes. So Nick, you would especially enjoy listening to some of his advice.
No, I will. I wouldn't have probably picked him out of a lineup. Looks like Next Level Nutrition is probably what his company is. And then you can get to the podcast. So nextlevelnutrition.com.au. And then I'm going to click on podcast. And there they are. He's got a ton. You know.
Fueling Endurance is the name of the podcast.
Yeah, Fueling Endurance podcast. Sodium supplementation for ultra running. Sweat and sodium hydration. Big topics. Hydration. Salt tablets. Yes.
He just did a research article, and one of his podcasts is actually about it. Where
nice.
People run on a treadmill for 5 hours, and he did different testing with their sodium intake, and
savage. So
the results are very interesting.
Nice. Okay. Well, we're going to plug him in here. We'll put him in the show notes also. But yeah, that's a great, great one. You didn't mess that one up at all. I love that answer.
Yeah. Unless people want to discuss journal articles, that's probably a better place to start than asking me for book recommendations.
Like it. All right, Megan. Well, obviously we're going to have you on some more. And if you ever have anything that just crawls into your ear, you want to complain about or applaud or just come on and just rant at me about, I'm here. So thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to see your face, and I'll see you in a few weeks in St. George.
Yep, and I'll hopefully have a smile, and I'll be running fast.
Yes, let's hope so.
All right, thanks, Meg. Talk soon.
Okay.